Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 144 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and let me introduce you to our co-hosts. First up, David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hi, Max. Hi, listeners. This is going to be a Rob bashing free zone this episode. At least I will refrain. I won't speak for my other co-hosts.
Yeah, we sure hammered Rob pretty good last episode. It turns out that Rob is off this episode. He's traveling and not available. So since we don't like to bash a guy who's not around, then there'll be no more Rob bashing.
At least for the first 5 minutes.
Right. Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hey, good evening, everyone. And a couple of caveats. First, I don't know who's this we you're talking about. I believe it was Stephanie who was the main culprit.
Our guest, huh?
I think I would thoroughly enjoy making fun of Rob, regardless of his presence. So,
okay,
I'm going to exclude myself from that statement.
Yeah, and because Rob is gone, we've got I guess you'd call him a guest co-host. This is Chris Mano, who's been a guest several times in the past. Chris, welcome back.
Great to be here. It's always nice to be here. You guys have a really good aviation forum going on here.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Well, we have a special guest this episode. That's Igor Sikorsky III. The grandson of the man who many consider to be the father of the helicopter industry. And as you'll learn later, that he's really the man behind much more than just helicopters. It's a fascinating story, and we'll look forward to speaking with Igor in a few minutes. Coming up first, though, we're going to talk the aviation news from the past week. Then we'll follow that with our conversation with Igor Sikorsky. David has his aviation history segment, and then Stephen Grant will bring us their Australia desk report. Peter Johnson's got an Across the Pond segment, and again, he talks with Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. We'll close out with a little bit of listener mail. First, though, let's start with the week's aviation news. Our first story comes from CBS News. This is JFK runway collision. Who's to blame? I think by now everyone's probably seen the footage of the incident at John F. Kennedy International Airport. This was where an Air France A380 struck the left horizontal stabilizer of a Bombardier CAG-700. A380 was taxiing past, hit the CRJ, spun it around in kind of dramatic fashion. No injuries. There were 586 passengers and crew members across the two airplanes. Fortunately, no injuries. Chris, you're an airline captain. Who is to blame for a situation like this?
That's everybody's nightmare. I'm grateful that I can see my wingtip. I can see the left wingtip of the 737-800 out my window, and I am constantly either watching or telling my first officer, stick your head out there and make sure we're clear. And Kennedy is a nightmare it's not parallel and intersecting taxiways. There's a lot of arcing taxiways and some very narrow angles. And that aircraft that particularly, I don't think anyone has a lot of time in the 380. Even if you came off of the 747-400, you're still dealing with 50 feet of increased wingspan. So it's just,
wow.
To me, that's I have bad dreams sometimes that I'm taxiing and I hit something. That's my recurring nightmare. You know, it's not standing up in front of people, public speaking in my underwear. It's taxiing and hitting something.
Wow.
It's a nightmare. Kennedy is a nightmare because there's so much moving and so much moving so fast. Mm. And the dissimilar types, you have to catch your interval. You're not going to get a second time on the instruction. So there's so many things that could have gone wrong there. I feel bad for all of them.
You know, of course, there was damage to both airplanes. But the thing that amazed me, and it's probably just because I don't know, was that the CRJ spun around. I would have expected sort of the tail to get smashed off by the the wing of this A380, and certainly there's, like I say, there's damage to both, but the CRJ just pirouetted.
Yeah, it looked like a toy, and it's one of those things we've all said. They say, well, there's no damage. Like, okay, 5 years from now, when a tail falls off a CRJ, they're going to go, ooh, it was that one. So yeah, no, I can't believe there was no structural damage with the way that was whacked like a toy and spun around like that. I'm so glad no one was hurt on that, because that's got to knock you senseless. They bounce you off the side of the bulkhead there.
Sure, yeah. I think that inside the CRJ, the things would have been a little bit dramatic there as the thing rotated.
I'd like to know the details of who was cleared to do what. And I've always, you know, the standard thing in the airline cockpit is let the record show that the brakes were set when the collision occurred. So I'd like to know who it was that's going to get tagged with this one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, right, how that investigation proceeds.
Yeah, that's a nightmare.
When I was listening to coverage of this on ABC on Monday night, they made an offhanded comment that JFK got a – originally the spec was you needed a 100-foot-wide taxiway to be able to use the A380, and JFK got an exemption on the width of the taxiways that was like a 60-foot taxiway. But no one seems to be bringing that up. It just sort of was a passing comment, and I'm surprised there are other people who haven't said anything that maybe JFK shouldn't be operating the A380.
Well, and that's a good point. And if you see where they park those A380s, all the international terminals, it's in a Y-shaped terminal. It's not out there on the ramp. It's not with the tails out. It's in a such a – you know, I've taxied by there thinking, well, how the heck do they get that thing out of there? In and out of there. I think they tow it in, but it's like, my God, I don't even know how you push that thing back without hitting something else. It's a narrow, narrow area. You know, L.A., they have more space. The Qantas is flying those in and out of there. In fact, I was in LAX the other day, and there were two of them that were actually dwarfing a 7-4. If you've ever seen on my Twitter feed, I showed a picture that has the 7-4 in the foreground, and it's dwarfed by the 380 in the background. But, yeah, that's a very good point, David, that the exemption, that's like, well, that's great until you put in that mix like that, that traffic mix.
Well, there's more excitement at the airport these days. Apparently, we have more air traffic controllers falling asleep. We have this from Reuters. Aviation official quits over sleeping controllers. Randy Babbitt, the FAA administrator, is very upset that we have this occurring, continuing to occur again. And so Hank Krakowski, the director of the FAA's air traffic organization, has been let go.
And as of today, we're up to 6 sleepers. So clearly him resigning or being fired, depending on who you talk to, did not help the fact that we have air traffic controllers sleeping at the job.
You know, to me, though, this is not a professional concern. It's a physiological concern. Yes. And one of it is the things that factors is the work rules that allow them to, you can do an 8-hour shift. And if you want to, you can come back, do them back to back, or you can come back 2 hours later. And, you know, people are doing that. But physiologically, again, I don't think it's anything about professionalism. We've got the best aircraft traffic controllers I could ever hope for. And I fly in, you know, a couple of different countries. But this is a situation where they're so shorthanded and they're allowing people to stack up shifts like that. Well, nobody's going to be able to stay away.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Chris. And, you know, our very own Rob Mark had an interesting post on his Jetwine blog, which is titled FAA and Controllers Need to Wake Up. What Rob says is that controllers falling asleep is not the problem. It's merely a symptom of the problem. And then Rob describes that the core issue is and always has been the fatigue-inducing schedules controllers have worked since the beginning of time. Schedules normally rotate so a controller's shift almost never begins at the same time each day, each week, a circadian rhythm-destroying strategy sure to make people doze. In his post, he talks with someone, the president of Alertness Solutions, Lay White, who says that just a 4-hour sleep loss can impair human performance equal to drinking a 6-pack of beer. Rob says that means sleepy controllers and pilots are operating with a brain that functions as if they were legally drunk. So, I mean, Chris, Rob is sort of saying the same thing that you are, is that the way these folks are scheduled only increases the likelihood that there's going to be fatigue and someone's going to fall asleep.
Yeah, and as you said, the context there in their job, it requires very specific and very repetitive function that it would be so hard to maintain your attention in that situation. But I'll tell you, one of the things that when we first heard about the air traffic controller, and it was one of our jets going into National, my biggest question was, that the controller was asleep, is that everything that is designed for no radio communications or NORDO is designed that the aircraft's radios fail and you don't land until you get a signal from the tower, which is actually literally a green light. They landed anyway. It's like, well, now how did that work? Because there are no procedures for if the tower has zero communications other than that green light. And, I don't like to second guess anyone, but yeah. I think I'd be on my way to Dulles, which is only like 12 miles north and further west. But, there are no contingencies for the tower having no control, no communication, other than a green light.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you land or why you do.
Yeah, didn't realize that. That is very interesting. Is the pilot community extremely concerned about what's going on here?
I don't think so. Not at all. And the mainstream, even if you have a problem with the center controller, it's almost like when you have an aircraft that flies past a frequency changeover, eventually somebody sends them an ACARS message that they need you on such and such frequency. I don't at all. I don't even think it's a safety issue. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. I don't think it's a big deal. It's getting a lot of press because people like to have the shock value of, oh my God, air traffic controllers are asleep. But that, to me, it's a non-issue. And they are the most professional bunch you could ever hope for. This is an issue. If anything that the controllers personally may be at fault at is that they're doubling up the income by doubling up the shifts when they really shouldn't. But there's such a shortage that's being allowed. But that may go out the door.
Yeah, we may see that go.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Next up, this is from the Seattle Times. U.S. has kept up Libya airstrikes. Now, this is kind of interesting. The article says U.S. warplanes had continued to strike targets in Libya even after the Obama administration said the United States was stepping back from offensive missions and letting NATO take the lead. Officials said that, these Libyan targets were classified as defensive, not offensive, and so I guess that makes them allowable. David, what do you think?
It's semantics, but when it comes to taking out radars, the United States is the best at it in the world.
And why is that?
We have the best equipment. I mean, we have aircraft that are designed, like the EA-18 Growler, that is designed specifically to have the ability to take out radars. I mean, that's what it's designed to do. There's other countries that have aircraft that have the capabilities of doing it, but we in the United States have aircraft that are specifically designed to do it. There's a difference. So further down in the article, they do talk about the fact that the majority of the United States missions, and I'm going to use the word I hate to use, but this is why we needed them, is air-to-air refueling, otherwise known as tanking. We are doing the majority of the air-to-air refueling for NATO. And that's why we needed the KC-46. So the headline is not necessarily the reality. We're not going to step away. Yes, the French and the British and the Italians and the Norwegians are taking the brunt of the offensive capabilities. But when it comes to specific missions like precision bombing or taking out radars, there's nobody better than the United States.
So it sounds like that what we're doing is the right thing to do, and it makes sense to do it.
Absolutely.
All right. Sounds good to me. I'm happy if David's happy.
Well, David's right. The United States Air Force designed the Weasel mission, and the Navy does a hell of a job of it as well. And that's the whole thing, that most of the NATO forces are very good at tactically. But when it comes to air superiority, first is ground suppression and radar suppression so that you cannot be targeted. And again, the Weasel mission, the F-15s and the F-18s, there's nothing comparable to it.
Sounds great.
David, wouldn't you think that the Air Force as well wants to do that? I mean, that's a kind of a proving mission. It's kind of a fine tuning of our armaments and our technology.
Yeah, but the Air Force really gave away when they took out the F-4Gs and they did not replace it. Although the Air Force does have the capability with the F-16CG, which is the F-16. Capable of shooting HARMs. Carries usually a pair of HARMs. The difference is we don't have the jammers that we don't have the package that the Navy has. The Navy has the A-18 Growler can jam, and if it's not jamming it can take it out. So the Air Force doesn't have that dual capability. They have a singular capability with the HARM shooters. Mm-hmm. I think basically the Air Force is perfectly happy with the Navy doing the jamming and shooting at the same time. And I don't think the Air Force will ever get back into the Weasel mission other than with the F-16s. Mm. And eventually the F-35, possibly, maybe, but it might be. I don't see that as a start mission for the F-35. The F-18, the EA-18G Growler is going to be the primary harm shooter slash jammer for all intra-service for the next 20, 30 years.
Interesting.
Okay, thanks, David. Our last article comes from CNN Travel. Frontier Airlines reduces fees. The article says air travelers are used to airlines raising or adding fees, so they may be shocked to hear that one carrier is actually reducing some of them. Dan, what's Frontier up to?
So, yeah, it is kind of cool, Max, to see an airline actually reduce some fees. So, for example, on economy fares for Frontier, the change fee is coming down from $100 to $50. On Frontier's classic fare, the change fee is now there is no change fee. And honestly, I really liked the approach that Frontier has taken to ancillary revenue. I think they're very transparent about it. They have their air fares program, and fares is F-A-I-R-S. And they have three fares: economy, which is the cheapest, classic, which is slightly more expensive, which includes things like two checked bags, but also the lower change fee. And then the classic plus was your full refundable fare, which has some more perks. So I really like how Frontier is transparent about it. As to what's motivating this, it could be the fact that, especially on the change fee, Frontier is in two hubs, Milwaukee and Denver, very competitive markets. Denver with United, and also Southwest Milwaukee with AirTran, which will, as long as the merger happens and is approved as planned, will become Southwest. So and Southwest has been advertising pretty heavily its lack of bag fees and change fees, so that could be part of it. But I think it's a nice pro consumer move. The other item that Frontier slipped in the news release, they're actually going to be launching the Frontier Express brand. And Q400 and ERJ operations will fall under the Frontier Express brand. And I guess I found that interesting for a couple of reasons. Just usually in the airline industry, you'll see any operation operated by a carrier other than the mainline carrier will have a different brand. So, you know, everything that Delta outsources is Delta Connection. But in this case, Frontier, that brand will be for the Airbus and the E-170, E-190 operation, which is flown by Republic. And also, it's found interesting because Frontier, before they were acquired by Republic, and also before that, they had Republic operating as Frontier. Before that, they had the Frontier Jet Express brand, which was actually operated by Horizon. So it's an interesting brand history, at least for people with no life like myself. So, anyway.
Joining us as our guest on this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is Igor Sikorsky III. Welcome to the show, Igor.
It's very nice to be here, Max. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with you, and then we'll talk about your grandfather. Now, you and I met a few years ago, and I remember you told me you had two dreams in life. You told me that you wanted to become a pilot, and you wanted to run a sporting camp. And you've accomplished both, but they're kind of a bit interrelated. Tell us a little bit about the Bradford camps.
It is a dream come true for me. We're just about to enter our 16th year. The Bradford camps is a very traditional remote sporting camp in northern Maine. It's 50 miles away from the nearest town, nearest paved road. We generate our own power. We have satellite telephone, and it's a traditional hunting and fishing camp. It was a childhood dream, again, of being the guide and the proprietor of a place like that.
Your preferred mode for getting there is your float plane, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
How long have you been a pilot?
Well, I have wanted to be a pilot since, you know, the earliest days of folding a paper airplane. But it just seemed to, you know, I finally took the bull by the horns, I guess, when I was about 29 and a half years old. And I thought to myself, I can't turn 30 without taking a flight lesson.
Great.
And it was pretty much that day that I went in and made a reservation to learn how to fly.
And what do you fly?
I fly Skyhawk. It's straight floats. I actually don't even switch over to wheels. I just leave it in a hangar in the winter. It's pretty highly adorned. It's got a 180 horse engine. They're big floats. I have close to 1,000 pounds useful on it, so it's a good workhorse.
You know, Igor, in the last couple of episodes, there's actually been a little bit of a conversation about float planes and the transition from a standard airplane to one with floats.
Yep.
And I mean, did you start out right from the beginning with floats, or did you transition?
No. Yeah, I just went the normal route. I ended up with 60 hours and a 150.
Right.
You know, keep it cheap and learn the basics. And that was certainly, you know, had its difficulties learning that, like everybody knows. And from there, I put some time in a Citabria tailwheel, which I kind of found even harder, even knowing how to fly. You know, there's just a lot more to it. And then the float plane is even that much more. Water ops are, you know, there's so much going on. You just don't have any brakes, and you got to make a lot of decisions way ahead of time. So it's really interesting flying.
How many hours did it take you to do the transition? How many flying hours do you think before you became really proficient with the floats?
Oh, well, the float rating is really a pretty simple 6 to 8 hour course. And I can't recall exactly what I went through, but it's probably something like, you know, between 6 and 10 hours, you know, 1 hour a week here and there. But I learned from a fellow on the Merrimack River in Massachusetts, and he was not willing to let anybody solo in his plane. So I got the rating, and, you know, I was either flying with him or with the check ride guy. And then I put that away until about 8 years later when I actually bought a float plane. And my first solo in a float plane was flying back to camp in my Skyhawk.
Fantastic. Chris, have you ever flown on floats?
No, and I have heard, and it's common knowledge, it's probably the most difficult rating you can get because there are so many variables, everything from runway heading and, as you said, no brakes. And I just can't even imagine. That must be quite a challenge. I'd love to see that. I don't think I want to undertake that myself, and I know several who have, and they've all said it's a very difficult course to do and to master and to become more than proficient to be good at it. So, no, that's amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a great exercise. Even if you don't use it, I think it makes all of your skills as a regular pilot better. You know,
I could see where that would do that because you have to focus on all the essentials. There's no runway heading. You know, there's no downwind. Right. I mean, you have to make those decisions. Plus, I imagine you have a lot of orographic interference from the topography around whatever water body there is, and that is going to be some very weird thermals, very weird currents. That'd be very unpredictable.
That's right, Chris. And really, you're never landing on a runway. You are making your own runway every time you land. You could be landing in familiar water, and you have to keep your eye out for, you know, some half-submerged log that could be there. And if the wind's blowing, then you have waves. You have different landing techniques, different attitudes you have to hold for different, you know, approaches and takeoffs to try not to beat your airplane up too much when it's windy.
I bet there's a lot of weird wind phenomena that are associated with open water as well.
Yes and no, I guess. You know, you don't – it depends. If you're landing in a river, which happens a lot, you know, then you could be in a treed corridor that's narrower than your average runway also. So, yeah, you get a lot of wind shear. I don't get into really tight stuff myself, but, you know, there's certainly many places in the bush where the runway is not straight. You know, the river takes a curve.
I can't imagine what factor there is when you have a river running whichever direction it's running as far as landing and taking off. I mean, how do you get the takeoff speed? You know, ground speed is ground speed. It's not moving, but you're in a moving fluid body. How does that work?
That's the thing you can talk about forever and ever in the hangar. You know, is it better to take off into the wind downstream or, you know, do you want to, you know, and it really just varies. Every takeoff is different, and you just have to make those decisions based on a lot of different factors. And it becomes, like anything, it becomes, you know, something that you're very familiar with and comfortable with, and you stay within your comfort zone.
Sounds like more of an art than a science, and so you have to be pretty good at it to make sure you have the clearances and all, you know, obstacle clearances, things like that, when you have a moving runway, essentially.
Absolutely. And, you know, the more I've got 1,000 hours. I'm a very, what I call myself, a low time pilot compared to all these pilots I associate with and stuff. But 800 of that is on floats in the North Main Woods. So it is, I think it's just a comfort level that you end up gaining. And, you know, I'm not flying into a lot of unfamiliar waters, but I do from time to time. And that's another thing. If you land on a lake that has some submerged rocks and shallow stuff, you have to fly over it a lot and figure out how you're going to fly out of there. You can't just land on what you know is good. You got to remember what it's going to look like when you're on the ground and how you're going to get out of these waters.
Yeah, so that's fascinating.
A lot of stuff to think about, yeah.
And you essentially have no nav aids. There's simply no VASI. There's nothing, right?
There aren't, but I'll tell you what. I have a Garmin 396. I just loaded it with Topo, and it's really pretty bomb-proof. You know, it's a VFR tool, but it has so much information. I load it with weather. You know, the weather's 10 minutes old or whatever, but it's still there. You can tell when the front's coming. But, yeah, no, you're right. It's all VFR flying that I do, and that's, you know, for me, the joy of flying anyways.
Can you do any night operations at all? Or?
You know, you can. I'm a 135 pilot. I'm not certificated for night ops because I'm a VFR. But full moon, you can see plenty. You know, there's a lot out there. But generally, people just stay away from that. I mean, you can't make out bad stuff on the water. So, you know, it's not worth it.
Fascinating.
Yep.
Now, Igor, when I visited the Bradford camps, it was for your Sikorsky weekend. Tell our listeners about that 3-day weekend.
Well, as you probably have figured out, and I know you know, Max, but I am the grandson of Igor Sikorsky, proud to be. And when we took over the camps, it also was about the beginning of me really delving into his history and kind of falling in love with that side of my family and my heritage, and it's a great story to share with people. So it's become a pretty popular thing for floatplane pilots to fly into, and just interested people to drive up. I think you probably drove up when you came.
That's right. About 4 hours on dirt logging roads. It was it was quite exciting. It's kind of its own adventure.
That's right. It's a long driveway. That's what I like to call it.
Yes,
it's three moose in from town.
That's right.
I have a little slideshow type thing, and I share with the visitors that we get of his history. He had a very significant career in Russia as a aircraft designer. He built the world's first multiple engine aircraft and the world's first enclosed cockpit aircraft, which are significant achievements. World War One, for a very large part of World War One, the largest aircraft were Sikorskys flying off the Russian fields.
I think a lot of people don't realize that.
That's right. Yeah, people think of Sikorsky as the father of the helicopter, and that's very true.
Right.
While there were other helicopters that had flown before him, he really solved the problem and, you know, dedicated the second half of his life to that. But he also had, not only in Russia, his career there, but he had a significant career in America building airplanes for Pan Am Airways. He built the first commercial aircraft for the Atlantic and Pacific crossings and South American travel, large flying boats. And,
right.
There's really three careers of his life, which he was very deeply involved with and highly successful at, and humble all the way along, which is maybe one of the more interesting parts of him as a person.
Yeah, that's easy to pick up on. I was looking at a write-up by Judy Neal. I don't know if you're familiar with Judy Neal, but she writes about people who've been influential in a variety of different ways. And I thought it was interesting. She wrote, I'll just read this little two paragraphs. She said, "I learned about Igor Sikorsky when I taught an MBA course at Sikorsky. None of the young engineers and managers had ever met Mr. Sikorsky. He died 30 years ago. Yet when they spoke of him, their voices were filled with awe, and a few had eyes that glistened with tears. You could feel a deep sense of love and respect for the man who founded the company they worked for." I think it's amazing that, you know, you'd have that kind of reaction for someone who had been gone for 30 years at the time that was written.
I can believe that with all my heart. I actually just visited the Sikorsky plant last weekend, and I have the wonderful privilege of being able to take a tour through the plant and see my grandfather's office, which is kept basically exactly the way it was when he worked there, which, by the way, he worked there up until 82 years old, the day he died.
My gosh.
So, yeah. And definitely that feeling still pervades at the, it's a workplace full of people that still have the same vision and sense of sensitivity that he did when he worked there. It's really fun. interesting stories about him as a leader.
Sure.
There. Yep.
So I kind of view the history as it's kind of occurring in different segments. I mean, there was sort of your grandfather in Russia and then immigrating to the United States and I guess attempting to develop the helicopter and having some difficulty with it, then going on to fixed wing airplanes and then coming back to the helicopter. Are those kind of discrete phases? Is that the way to think of it?
Absolutely. In fact, the first two aircraft that he built, to get the timeline correct, were two helicopters in Russia.
Oh.
Grossly underpowered, grossly inadequate in technology, and grossly overweight. But he very lovingly would say that they produced all of the characteristics of today's modern helicopter. In his later years, he'd say they produced huge clouds of smoke. They were very loud, and they had many fascinating vibrations. I love that one.
Yeah.
And but they had one technical difficulty: they would not fly. And so, realizing that the helicopter was not of age in Russia in 1909 and 10, he moved on to fixed wing, and that was his career in Russia. The revolution came along. Certainly on the wrong side of the revolution, he was building aircraft for the military and knew generals and involved a little bit militarily, but mostly in a design standpoint. Left Russia, penniless, came to America, very small knowledge of the English language, and in short order proceeded to build one-at-a-time designs on Long Island, eventually gaining success after about 5 years building float planes or seaplanes, flying boats. And then flying boats were a really short-lived part of aviation. They were maybe a 10-year span, basically a crossover time waiting for airports to be built.
And, right. And that's why they were popular initially, correct? Is that yes, there weren't airports and other than the, you know, the open water. That was used as the as the airport.
Yep, and major cities were all built on big waters. If you think about it, there was an airport at the waiting right there. So it filled a perfect niche, but only for a short while. And when the orders dropped off for these big flying boats, there was a particular day when an officer of United Aircraft at the time that owned Sikorsky. So of course, my grandfather sold quickly, as soon as possible, the operating expenses, operating part of the company, and became the chief engineer. That was a tremendous drag for him to have to manage a company. So, and they came to him, and a man came to him and said, you know, we are going to have to close your company. There are no orders for these flying boats anymore. And with a twinkle in his eye, he looked across the table, not daunted at all, and he said, I have one more idea that I would like to propose. And an hour later, he had this officer of the company who was actually walked into his office to let my grandfather go. An hour later, he was walked back to the president's office and said, no, we're not letting him go. We do have to keep him. He's working on the next phase, the helicopter.
I think when I met you, you described it as kind of your grandfather first had to figure out how to build a helicopter, and then he had to figure out how to fly it.
Correct. He would often say that early aviation was very efficient at weeding out the poor engineers. and it's quite true. But you're right. In helicopters, in airplanes that he built in the early years in Russia, he had no knowledge of how to design an aircraft. It was 6 years after the Wright brothers had flown. And think about it, in Russia, news didn't get to Russia until 4 of those years had gone by. And so he also had to figure out how to build an airplane without having ever built an airplane before. He was, you know, going to the hardware store and getting piano wire and had to make his own dope to paint the canvas of the wings, to shrink the wings.
Right.
And, you know, had to design all this stuff and didn't understand what tolerances were allowed. His first airplanes didn't fly very well. His wing shape was not very efficient. His fabric was very loose. But gradually, piece by piece, he then learned. And what's interesting, that the last step is learning how to fly. That's no small feat. But his first airplane that he built, the S-1 in 1910, was powered by a 15-horsepower motor.
Wow.
So the intuition that he used, not knowing how much power, but imagine probably many people would say, we need a lot of power because we don't really know what we're doing, and but we'll need a lot of power to compensate for all these other things.
Mm.
That would be what would get you into trouble then. This S-1 aircraft weighed something between 600 and 800 pounds loaded, 15-horsepower engine, and you know the result is quite foreseeable. It didn't fly.
Yeah.
That probably saved his life.
Ah, good point.
Because he didn't know what to do. But he did spend many months doing high-speed taxi with a tail-wheel aircraft, a tail-dragging aircraft, and finally understood that really the only way to keep the tail behind you was to aggressively stomp on that on the earliest, you know, feeling that your tail was about to wrap around in front of you. And this was a learning curve that he used every single minute of power on was a learning step for him.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
So yeah, it is an incredible, the beginning years, the S1, S2, S3, and S4 together accumulated a total flight time of less than 5 minutes in the air.
Gee, wow.
Yep.
Huh.
It is. And so they all ended in some sort of crack up, walked away from everything. Believe that he did not break a bone in his body throughout his life, which is
kind of lucky in a way, I
guess. Lucky, yeah. But of course, good judgment. There was one crack up in the S-5, which was a flying aircraft, the first aircraft. He actually took off and landed on a flight plan, a local flight, but a flight plan that he had prearranged and was able to complete per the flight plan. So, but another flights into that, his engine quit, and the only suitable landing spot in front of him was a little railroad yard with maybe 200 feet long with a stone wall at the end, and he literally smashed the landing gear in order to stop the plane. He landed hard. Otherwise, a good landing would have put him right into the rock wall. And that, his inspection of the engine revealed a mosquito in the carburetor.
My gosh.
Yeah. And that's what quit the engine, which made him think of the next positive solution to aircraft design was multiple engines. And so that was his a learning experience for him. Crashing his aircraft into a railroad yard was the next step will be a multiple engine aircraft, which at the time, 1912, no one ever would believe that an aircraft with two engines, it was well believed that an aircraft over 2,000 pounds was unflyable, completely proven by the fact that large birds like, you know, the emu cannot fly, so large planes won't be able to fly either.
Well, how interesting.
It's a scientific fact. So the naysayers throughout his life, you know, never mind the helicopter, but his airplane career was quite the same.
So we can attribute multi-engine airplanes to your grandfather and a mosquito.
Yes, right. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Now, wasn't he the designer of the first four-engine airplane?
The first commercial? Clearly the first four-engined aircraft. That's right. And that was the Ilya Muromets aircraft. They actually went into production in World War II in Russia. They built some, I believe, 85. The numbers are not exact, but it's something like 85 models of the Ilya Muromets. Every single aircraft was different because they were all custom built. They all did, though, have four engines between 150 and 220 horsepower. They all had enclosed cockpits. They had observation platforms. They had simple bombardier sights, and they were used for reconnaissance and some aerial bombing. Also, the first tail gunner. These aircraft were huge, slow, very juicy targets for the German aircraft, and of course, completely unprotected from the rear.
Sure.
So many, many stories of aircraft barely surviving aerial attacks. One aircraft was so shot up when it returned from a flight over enemy territory that, and it was the static wires, if you know what I mean, were shot out, but right, the flight wires were still intact. When the aircraft stopped its taxi, the wings collapsed. That was a shot up aircraft. Another one was lost its elevator control, and they were able to maintain altitude by the tail gunner adjusting the location of the center of gravity by moving the tail gunner fore and aft. He was on a trolley to get back to the tail. It was such a small tail space that he would ride back there on a trolley, and they could literally trim the aircraft by moving this back and forth.
Yeah. Wow.
But they were able to service these engines in flight. Service engines might mean putting fires out, might mean tightening up a leaking fuel line, and all of these things happened quite often. You know, think of the technology of an engine design back then. Lock washers, I think, were, you know, a rare, just the machining quality, and they were still able to get this type of performance out of these aircraft even back then. So,
Interesting.
It is.
I have a question concerning, believe it or not, the pronunciation of the word helicopter. I found an article in the Seattle Times from recently that says Charles Lindbergh, who made the first solo flight across the Atlantic in 1927,
right,
brought a toy helicopter to his grandson on Bainbridge Island in the early 1970s. And Eric, who I guess is the son, thanked him for the helicopter, the pronunciation used today. Then it goes on, but Charles Lindbergh, who had long ago collaborated on projects with helicopter pioneer Igor Sikorsky, said helicopter, the pronunciation he'd heard from the man many consider to be the father of the modern helicopter. Had you heard that before? Is there any basis for that story, or is that just some folklore?
Oh, I think that's very, very much true. My grandfather had a significant old school Russian accent that he carried with him through his life. He pronounced all of the EDs on the end of a past tense verb. Discovered how to solve the problem of the flying machine in the helicopter. He certainly did say helicopter. I don't think he was trying to pronounce it in a different way than what was normally, you know, people would use, but he just had this this very scholarly European accent that was really captivating. I've listened to him a lot and remember his gentle character as a child, but also listened to the tapes of his speeches, and I'll send you one too. You can hear a pin drop. Nobody's going to miss a word. He had that quality about him that was every little sentence that he had was well thought out. It was rich in information, and it was just pleasantly delivered. Really an amazing man all the way around in terms of, you know, he was just a great man. He had many other deep interests, interest in astronomy. He had a very close, deep interest in religion. He was a highly religious man. He believed wholeheartedly in God, the Father, creator of everything, and that when you die, you do go to heaven. His idea of heaven is best looked at from his idea of Earth. And his idea of Earth, this is his mystical quality coming out. You don't hear about that much, but that this is a learning place, a stepping stone, if you will, and everybody has an opportunity to take a giant leap on Earth and learn a lot about the world and their soul, and or not. And and then you move on through the cosmos to something else. It's an interesting part of his character also.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
David, do you have any questions or anyone else?
Oh, I got lots of questions, but he stole my thunder by talking about my favorite Sikorsky airplane.
Which one?
the Ilya Murmansk.
And David, why is that your favorite Sikorsky airplane?
It just looks cool. If you like World War One airplanes, and from a modeling standpoint, it would be a nightmare to build as a scale model because it's a million miles of rigging and wiring, and it's sort of got a it's kind of a weird shape. It's sort of got a boxcar lookish cockpit that's squared off, and the Russians used them as bombers. They were throwing the bombs out the side of the aircraft. It's just one of my all-time favorites. Between that and I like the S-42, which is the Clipper, the Pan Am Clipper.
Very significant machine, yes.
So I like the Sikorsky airplanes even more than the Sikorsky helicopters. The Sikorsky airplanes are cool. There's a lot of people who do history, who know about Sikorsky's other lives building airplanes, but most people I don't think realize the aviation career he had before the helicopter career. And to this day, I still love watching that series of films where he's flying around in the VS-300 and they're putting in mail packages in this little wicker basket that looks like it came off of a bicycle on the front of the VS-300 that he's, and then he goes flying off on the pontoons. It's really kind of neat that, Igor, that you are a float plane man, because he had a significant career building aircraft that landed on water, helicopters and airplanes.
Correct. You're absolutely right. Even maybe you don't know, the Ilya Murmansk, which in the height of their production reached over 22,000 pounds, not a small aircraft. World War One, reminding. But going back to the boxy look, they were actually built in a railroad car factory. Big building, a lot of workers who knew how to handle wood and get stuff together. And so, yeah, it was a railroad car, a lot lighter, I think, but on wings. Really cool aircraft. And then, yeah, I'm very, float flying is the apex for me. I feel the closest, I think, that I could ever feel. I feel the closest at this point to my grandfather when I'm taking off on some new body of water and it's, heads up flying. And he had to do that all the time. He's flying these Ilya Murmansk off of potato fields in Russia, not runways back then. And he had to have the same concerns and the same interests. And then, of course, the same joy when a flight is going well that I feel. So I feel really, really close to him, certainly when I'm in the air.
Though my one real question is, why did he insist the pilot fly a helicopter on the right-hand side of the aircraft?
It's actually a great question, and it's a pretty simple answer, and it has to do with the stick and the collective. The stick reacts in the helicopter just like flying a plane. When you're flying in forward flight, the stick does all that, and most pilots in fixed-wing aircraft flying the stick with their right hand. That's where their best dexterity is. They held on to that principle. The left hand was then used for the collective pitch, which has a lot of machinations going on there, and RPM and power settings and collective. In the early helicopters, there was only one collective pitch. So that had to be in between the two seats, which puts the pilot on the right side.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I always wondered if it in rotary wing, did it have something to do with the way the torque would move the aircraft that would make it that you would have the best or the most predominant ability to see the route of flight left or right because of the way the airplane is going to naturally yaw from the right? Is there anything to that? The rotation of the rotor and then the torque that you get, if you fly any high torque aircraft, it's going to favor one side or the other. Was there anything to that?
Sure. I don't think so. Could be, certainly. But I think the primary reason was they're trying to keep these things as simple as possible. It's the most complicated flying machine, except for the, space shuttle. There's just tenfold the moving parts. Trying to keep it simple, one collective pitch was where they wanted to begin, and that, of course, had to be flown from both sides. But I think the control characteristics, there's the whole gyroscopic effects that are going on that, of course, have to be dealt with as a pilot and dealt with as a designer. And that collective pitch didn't start out down below on the left of the pilot. It had a number of different locations until they finally settled on that. And they had to build numerous models just to get the ergonomics correct on that. They didn't, you know, no one ever built a helicopter cockpit before either. So there's a great photo actually of the VS-300, which is the first successful Sikorsky helicopter. And it's in the manufacturing facility, and it's under the wing of the largest Sikorsky flying boat, the S-44. And, you know, this is I don't think that the VS-300 had a empty weight of over 1,000 pounds. It was a light aircraft. Maybe it was 1,500 pounds, about what my Skyhawk is. And next to this 4,400 horsepower S-44, monstrous flying machine, is a neat, you know, crossover into history, you know, from the tried and true, old and big and new. And as you can imagine, these workers in the plant, all of whom wondering what Sikorsky's folly is in the corner there, you know, from the perspective of somebody who'd never seen a helicopter before and never seen that fly, and then to see all this manpower going into it, you know, it's an interesting piece of history just to think of what everybody was going through in their minds.
What would you say, Igor, was his biggest success and his biggest failure?
Those are great questions, David. Boy, the success from a technical standpoint certainly was large, proving to people large airplanes would fly, proving to people that commercial aviation was worthwhile. He started building big airplanes before commercial aviation was really a normal thing. And then, of course, the helicopter. There were just three significant, and I don't think I could put one over the other. He lived a dream that came to fruition three times over, and even lived to see it continue on. He's literally alive when Neil Armstrong took a step on the moon. I think he was about 6 inches away from the TV because his eyes were failing him. He did meet Neil Armstrong after he came back, and it was to be a part of that whole span of aviation history and to be a significant part of that and to build machines that saved people's lives, I think was a really meaningful and a very satisfying part of his life. His dreams came true for him, and so many other people benefited from that.
And wasn't his dream for the helicopter to be a device that would save people's lives? I mean, he thought of that from the beginning, correct? I mean, it wasn't a matter of being enamored with just creating a helicopter for the sake of creating a helicopter, but he envisioned it as being an aircraft that could be used in ways that others could not be used for the benefit of all of us.
That's right. He had a wonderful little quote he would say, "When a man is in trouble and nothing can reach him, an airplane can come by and he can throw flowers on him, and that's about all." But the helicopter can do real work and help a man who's in trouble and do a number of. And he had another wonderful quote where, again, naysayers, you know, some noted aviation designer, you know, at a meeting with him said, "Mr. Sikorsky, you're building this helicopter. Do you know when it's going to be faster than the airplane?" And he said, "Yes, I know that. The answer is never." "Well, do you know when it's going to be able to carry more load than the airplane?" "Yes, I know that. Never." "And well, when's the helicopter going to be more efficient than the airplane? Do you know that?" "Yes, I know the answer to that. It'll never be more efficient," he said. "But the helicopter will do a number of jobs which no airplane can do and which nothing else can do." And he saw that niche. And you're right, his vision of it as a life-saving device was, I think, a very important part of his feeling of success. And he would meet, actually, with any pilot, crew member, or person who was saved in a helicopter who wanted to express thanks to my grandfather. He would always take time in his office to meet with them and hear the story of that life-saving mission.
That says a lot right there.
Yeah.
Says a lot about the man.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, Igor. We'd really like to thank you for joining us. I just want to mention that folks can find the website for the Bradford Camps at www.bradfordcamps.com. We'll put that in the show notes, of course. And, you know, having visited the camp, I have to say that, you know, forget aviation and history as a, you know, idyllic place to go and have a vacation, you know, with your family or otherwise. It's the North Main Woods are beautiful. The camp is fantastic. Along with, we should mention also, Igor, your wife, Karen.
Right.
Who, the two of you run the camp. And it's just a fantastic experience. And then on top of that, just imagine all that and then spending 3 days with Igor having conversations like we've just had, but also with the memorabilia you have, the artifacts, the films, right. All of that is just fantastic. I think the one thing, I don't know why, but the one thing I remembered kind of the most was, holding in my hands the State of Connecticut Helicopter Pilot License number 1 issued to Igor Sikorsky.
Right.
That was so cool.
Yep. And I don't have this one, but he was issued Helicopter Pilot License number 60. In 1910, he was issued Airplane Pilot's License number 62. He was the 62nd person in the world to receive a airplane license from the Fédération Aéronautique of France. That's where all airplane licenses were. That's a Smithsonian Institute artifact now. But it would be a pleasure to have you again up there, Max, and anybody else who's listening. We really enjoy what we do, and we seem to have something pretty special up there. And thank you for having me on your show.
It is. Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Fascinating. Very nice.
Thank you, Chris and David and Dan. It's very nice to meet you and hope to see you up there sometime.
And now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode number 12, April 17th through the 23rd. April 17th, 1964, Geraldine "Jerry" Mock completes the first solo around the world by a woman. Mock uses a modified Cessna 180. Two ferry tanks were added to the passenger compartment, bringing the total of fuel to 178 gallons. Continental donated the engine, which had an endurance of 25 hours. November 1538C, or 38 Charlie, eventually became known as the Spirit of Columbus. The flight started in March 19th, took 29 days with 21 stopovers and 22,860 miles. Mock's flight set 5 unofficial records: the first woman to fly solo around the world, the first woman to fly from the United States to Africa via the North Atlantic, the first woman to fly across the Pacific in a single-engine airplane, the first woman to fly the Pacific west to east, and the first woman to fly both the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. On top of those, she also had two official records: fastest a woman around the world, and at the time, fastest around the world. 38 Charlie can be found hanging from the ceiling of the Udvar Hazy Center of the Smithsonian Institution. April 18th, 1942. A Japanese fishing boat spots a U.S. carrier battle group. This causes the aircraft carrier to turn into the wind ahead of schedule and prep for aircraft launch. 16 B-25B Mitchells are launched on a one-way trip to China. The B-25Bs are stripped down to essential and all external armaments are removed. The only protection are the two broomsticks stuck through the back windows and painted to look like 50 caliber machine guns. Each bomber only had 4 500-pound bombs. In comparison, on a regular basis over Libya, we're currently dropping 2,000-pound bombs, and most aircraft, that's the standard weight of the ordnance. One 500-pounder out of the 4 was actually an incendiary. This was hoping to cause collateral damage over Tokyo due to the wooden structures. 10 members or 2 crew were never accounted for after the mission. The Doolittle raid would be a success for two reasons. One, it made the Japanese realize that the home islands were not invulnerable. Secondly, it was a huge propaganda victory for the United States because if Japan was struck in retribution for the attacks that had only occurred 4 months ago on December 7th, 1941. Believe it or not, as of this year, there are still five Doolittle Raiders left. Colonel Richard E. Cole, co-pilot of aircraft number one. Major Thomas C. Griffin, navigator of aircraft number nine. Lieutenant Colonel Robert L. Height, co-pilot of aircraft number 16. Major Edward Joseph Saylor, engineer of aircraft number 15. And Staff Sergeant David E. Thatcher, gunner of aircraft seven. And now some news from Dan. On April 18, 1980, Air Zimbabwe was formed with a fleet of five 707s. Currently, Air Zimbabwe operates a huge fleet of eight aircraft, three Boeing 737-200ADVs, two Boeing 767-200ERSs, and three ZIAN, X-I-A-N, MA-60. And after some research, I found out that this is a Chinese version of an AN-24, the NATO codename Coke. Now, I know we had Igor Sikorsky on this evening, but I need to support the hometown team. On April 22nd, 1985, Boeing Vertol BV-10711 makes its first flight from little old Ridley Park, Pennsylvania. The BV-107-11 was the civilian version of the United States Navy and Marine Corps CH-46 Sea Knight. The CH-46 is the frog in military parlance. The BV-107 was built by both Boeing and Kawasaki Heavy Industries. Now, for people who don't know, there are two different helicopters. There's the CH-46, which is the Sea Knight, and then there's CH-47, its big brother, the Chinook. You can tell the difference between the two by this. The CH-46 has one nose wheel and two small sponsons on the fuselage for the main gear. The CH-47 has two sets of nose wheels and has sponsons running the whole length of the fuselage. And last, on April 23rd, 1917, First Lieutenant Paul Frank Baer, B-A-E-R, after being with the Lafayette Escadrille, shoots down his fifth aircraft. Baer would go down to become the very first ace in the United States Air Service. Baer would go on to shoot on another four aircraft using his SPAD 13, or the XIII. He was shot down and then went on to spend the remainder of World War I as a prisoner of the Germans. First flights that occurred through the week of April 17th through the 23rd. The Grumman Tadpole, otherwise known as the A2F1 or the A6A Intruder, first flew on April 19th, 1960. And the Rockwell Aero Strike Commander, first flown on April 23rd, 1948. And that's the way it was, April 17th through the 23rd. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing out.
You had to throw in that Ridley Park helicopter item, didn't you?
Yeah, I caught that.
See, Igor's still listening.
I'm still here.
Now, Igor, you have to understand, I can look out my window and see the Boeing factory.
I love it. And, you know, not to sound like a preacher, but my grandfather would always tip his hat to everybody else who made strides in the industry and to make it work. You know, he never said he was the only one, but, you know,
yeah.
It took a lot. I mean, it was accumulation of everybody, and it still would have happened without him, you know.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, April 17th, 2011.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 144 of the Airplane Geek Show. Steve Vischer back with you once again. Yes, I am older. I've survived my 40th birthday, and Grant is with me. He was there to witness it. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. And yes, that's right. I was there for the festivities and was surrounded by a whole lot of Dutch. Yeah, didn't take them up on the opportunity to explain to me how to pronounce Schiphol.
Yes, Schiphol.
Okay.
Did you put lots of O's in it and use lots of phlegm?
Ah.
Mm.
Dutch courage, huh?
Absolutely. We're not going there. This is not the Dutch desk.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good idea, because let's move on then straight away into our first story, which relates to other places we shouldn't go, which is the idea that Tiger Airways might actually not be so bad at the time of budget cuts and oil prices going up.
Hang on. It's been so long since we've talked about our friends at Tiger Airways, we haven't dropped in the customary sound effect. Did you say Tiger Airways? Oh, I feel so much better now.
Go Cat. And it may very well be Go Cat, mate, because they're saying that even though oil prices are going up and airlines all around the world are in trouble, and Tiger did get a bit of a pummeling of its shares with the impact of the various floods and natural disasters here in Australia, because they've put a bit of a stop to a lot of people going on holiday travel. Even though all that's going on and they may very well still not make a profit in the fourth quarter, they reckon they're in a pretty good position to win in the near future as people go for the bargain airlines because they have less spending money.
Well, this is according to a report, Grant, actually, by the Bank of Scotland, of all people. And if anybody knows money, I guess it's the Bank of Scotland.
Well, they're very canny with other people's money.
Absolutely. So, yeah, then that makes a lot of sense. And in fact, we've talked about that a lot with the problems that Qantas has been having, obviously being a legacy or a traditional type carrier. And, even within their own group with Jetstar, there's been a flow of passengers away from Qantas mainline through to Jetstar, the budget carrier. So it only makes sense, I guess, that people would also be looking at Tiger Airways, which at least on the surface of it, when you look at their base fee before they put 58 different charges on, is probably cheaper than most other airlines most of the time.
Well, if you know what to expect and you know how to work it, you can go in and you can actually get things to work with Tiger, so long as they don't have to cancel or have any mechanical or weather delays. You know, if you go in expecting it to be a bus going from point to point, you do the bare minimum, you don't actually buy anything on board, and try and travel with the minimum luggage, you're generally pretty okay.
It's interesting here, Grant, that Tiger Airways shares during the week dropped to $1.35 Singaporean dollars per share, and although they did rebound a bit to about $1.50 Singaporean. Yeah, so that sort of makes their shares actually quite a bit more valuable than Virgin Blue shares, for example.
Yeah, that is interesting about various stock prices, but I'm not sure that the stock prices are actually having an impact on the discount airfares, although this news about discount airfares going up may see some stock prices both here and in Singapore going up. The federal government's domestic airfare index shows the latest available fares this month are 23% higher than at the same time last year and 18% higher than last month.
The interesting part about that is that we've been looking at the way Virgin Blue in particular has been repositioning their business, particularly probably since John Borghetti took over, but I think maybe even before that time. You know, when they first started out in this country, they came in as a discount carrier. I don't think really anybody seriously regards them as such these days. That's really not the way they operate. They're, you know, they're sort of pushing a bit more towards the premium market these days and trying to chase the business traveller. And I think that, combined with a lot of other economic factors, is forcing their fares upwards.
That's right. And fares in general are going up as well because fuel charges are up. Qantas, we've been reporting on them putting their prices up. The cost of living is going up, folks. Cost of oil is going up. A lot of things are increasing, which in turn are meaning that they've got to increase their prices. And this is a classic indicator. Now, admittedly, aviation is typically a lagging indicator, but it is another indicator that we're going to be paying more for everything pretty soon. And that's even without the carbon tax.
Oh, you mentioned the carbon tax, Grant. I was going to mention the carbon tax.
Oh, I thought I'd jump in before you did.
Ah, boy, makes my blood boil. I don't slot talk about that at all. Let's have a talk about something else to do with the government, Grant, and that's the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC. Now, this is the government body in this country that's charged with overseeing business and making sure that everybody's playing fairly.
That's right, and they've recently been in the news investigating the somewhat monopolistic practices of various airports around Australia, and now they're seeking comment on these proposed charging increases by air services. Air services provide all the airways fees and so on that we all have to pay whenever we go fly, shoot an ILS and so on. And they're wanting to assess the monopoly of the aviation rescue and firefighting and various other air traffic control services that are being priced. Because, Steve, I understand they've just put out a new pricing guide.
Yeah, there's lots of, they're talking here about a 6.1% increase. This is Air Services Australia for their air navigation in route charges and, in fact, their terminal navigation services. You know, that's 6.1% increase is quite above the CPI, even in these times where the cost of living is going up, Grant, as you're talking about. But 6.1% seems pretty high. The Aviation Rescue and Fire Services, well, you see, I have this problem with privatisation, and let's face it, even though Air Services Australia is a business, it's a government-run business. These are the sort of things that you pay your taxes for anyway, in my opinion, and Aviation Fire Services is, you know, a component of that. So I don't know why they try and even corporatise it and run it as a business. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all, Grant. But anyway, they're saying here that for IFR aircraft with a max takeoff weight of 20 tonnes or more, the formula is price times distance divided by 100 times the square root of the max takeoff weight.
Well, what happened to factor X, mate? Because as soon as I heard that little calculation, all I could think of was this.
Starting from where we are, we go 33,600 turbo miles due up, then west in an astro arc deviation to here. Then, following the Great Circle, 7 radio lubes south by down east. By astro-astrobo to here, here, and here. Then by space navigable compass to here, here, and then to here, and here. By 13-point stratocumulus bearing 4 million light years, and thus to our destination.
Well, that sounds like the head of Air Services Australia to me, Grant. I think they all talk like that over there, don't they?
Well, you know, mate, they were used to say that the aircraft couldn't take off until the weight of the paperwork equaled the weight of the aircraft. But I think now it's more the aircraft cannot take off until the calculations of the lawyers and accountants have equaled the calculations of the flight plan.
So interesting. And of course, you know, if they put these en route charges up, that, like everything, is just going to be passed straight on to the customer, which kind of flows back into what we were talking about in the previous article there, Grant, is the cost of running the services goes up. That all gets passed on through to the customer, and that in turn forces up fares.
That's right. And here in Australia, we are going with a pseudo user pays. Unfortunately, aviation, we don't have enough consumer bodies or general population jumping up and down to scream about it. So they put the prices up however they want. But mate, one of the other things that's gone on in runways and airports and so on is buildings. We've had a lot of airports here in Australia that have been privatised, and they've turned around and started putting commercial buildings, sometimes aviation related, but 90% of the time non-aviation related, as they divide up large parcels of airport land and allow large structures to be built reasonably close enough to runways, not so much in terms of a collision hazard, but more so much the turbulence that they generate when wind is blowing over the top of them.
Yeah, we see a lot of the airports, and we've talked a lot about in the past how airports that were previously government-owned in this country have all been privatised and sold off. And of course, pretty well the first thing that any of these big companies did when they bought these airports was look at the supposedly vacant land and, you know, sell it off. And in the case of our big GA airport here in Melbourne, which is Moorabbin, one of the runways at that airport has been rendered virtually useless now because they built a Coca-Cola factory at one end of it. It makes me harken back to an airport I used to fly at in the States. And if anybody is listening from Central Arkansas, you may have flown into Heber Springs Airport. I remember that that airport, when you come in, it's actually the runway on either side is actually sort of hemmed in by large cedar trees on either side. And you would be coming in, have it all nicely lined up, got your crosswind component in, if you like, and you'd sort of, and if the wind was sort of quartering along the runway at any given day and coming over those trees, it'd throw you off just as you were getting to flee. You'd sort of have to make an adjustment. So, I don't know, Grant, I sort of think that sort of comes into the skill of flying in a way. It perhaps is not the most comfortable way to fly, but maybe in these days of higher density living, when you're talking about a place like Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane, maybe that's just something that we have to live with as pilots and learn to increase our skills so that we can still land safely. I mean, if particularly if you know that that's going to be a factor, then it's something that you should be ready for as you're coming in short final.
This is it's one of the things that is coming out with the various Senate inquiries, and the current government are starting to look into the construction close to runways and the impact not just of the physical object, but its downwind impact as well. Let's see what happens on these runways and airports around the country. But leading on the topics of airports and runways, Sydney Airport celebrated its 100th anniversary of the first flight from the area that actually became Sydney Airport. Apparently, New Zealand pilot Captain Joseph Joel Hammond had a 10-minute flight on April 18, 1911, and he flew a Bristol box kite biplane from what was then Ascot Racecourse and is now today part of the site of the East-West Runway. Thousands of fascinated onlookers observed this.
Oh, good. And they got photos too, David. They got photos. Yeah.
Grant, photos of a pioneering Kiwi aviator here in Australia.
Oh, he's a Kiwi as well. There you go.
1911, the first flight out of what is now the Mascot Sydney Airport area.
Now, Grant, he was an aircraft under 20 tonnes, so that means presumably if he came in IFR, he would have been charged for max takeoff weight up to 20 tonnes is price times distance divided by 100 times max takeoff weight. Wonder how many shillings that was.
Well, I'm not sure how many shillings, but don't forget, back then IFR meant I follow roads.
Oh, nice. Well, there you go. We should really ask Rob what it was like flying back in those days.
I know.
Let's not pick on Rob. He got a hard time last week. Did you hear the show last week?
Oh, yeah. He got really bagged out on it. It was quite spectacular.
Yeah, and we weren't even there to witness it. Oh, well.
I know.
Did anybody get a photo? Oh, we've been there already.
Oh, way too many photos tonight.
No, I'm starting to sound pretty grumpy in my old age. So, Grant, I think I'll have my my cup of hot chocolate and head off to bed. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Well, thank you, Steve and Grant, for the Australia Desk Report.
By the way, speaking of Rob, I was talking to Aunt Benet this week, and she is completely behind the roast of Rob Mark idea. So
she would be. Of course she would be. We could do like rotating roasts or something. Roast a co-host. Next up, we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. Now, a little warning in advance. Peter's been having some computer problems, and the audio recording is not up to the usual standards. So Peter asks your indulgence, and he hopes to return to the usual audio quality next week. So here's Peter Johnson.
Well, today we welcome back Tim. Tim is the editor of Aerospace International, and Tim's joining us today to talk about the UK Rotary Fleet. Welcome back, Tim.
Hi there. Great to be back on the show again.
Thank you very much. Tim, how has the Defence Review affected the UK's Rotary Fleet?
Okay, well, Rotary's not done too badly out of this. The 12 extra Chinooks that were previously ordered for the RAF, they've been confirmed. Well, the full 24 is unlikely. The Lynx Wildcat, that's safe. There's going to be Pumas that are going to be upgraded, although slightly lower, 24 Pumas upgraded rather than 28. And there's also going to be the RAF Merlins are going to go to the Navy.
And in terms of our air sea rescue capability and anti-submarine capability, would aircraft are going to be undertaking that role?
Well, we've already got the Merlin in the anti-submarine role, which is a pretty potent piece of kit anyway. So that'll be doing part of the stuff that sort of Nimrod did. Now, on the search and rescue side of things, that's just a little slightly more complicated because one of the previous government's plans was to privatise search and rescue and to turn it into a public-private procurement project under a program called SAR-H. And this would see a mixed civil and military pilots flying helicopters owned by somebody else, but for the UK government. However, that has gone, entered a sort of a bizarre, yet another kind of defence procurement cock-up. It's been axed. So the question is now is how long can the sort of seekings keep going for? Possibly that might mean some kind of cockpit upgrade or engine upgrade or car some blades on the seekings to keep them going, but no new helicopters.
How are our lighter helicopter assets fared in the review?
The Army's done quite well in that it links Wildcat has sort of remained safe. Elsewhere, it operates the Apache and Gazelle. Yeah. Gazelle's probably on its due to be sort of eventually sort of phased out.
Yeah.
And the Apache, as reports from Afghanistan have shown, is providing sort of excellent close air support, firepower, even sort of surveillance and intelligence sort of capabilities.
Recently, you joined an exercise on Salisbury Plain.
Yeah, well, that was an exercise, Pashtun Jaguar, which was a two-week exercise supporting a Royal Marine Brigade that was about to deploy to Afghanistan. And involved in this exercise were RAF Chinooks, RAF Merlins, Army Air Corps Apaches, as well as Royal Marines seeking commandos, and also a Gazelle there as a sort of a surrogate UAV. although the exercise took place on sort of Salisbury Plain, it was highly realistic training for the air crews and the sort of soldiers involved supporting this. You know, ultra high level of training involving very, very realistic scenarios that they would encounter in theatre, such as people dropping their weapons after they've been planting IEDs, or an ambush on the way to a village meeting that goes wrong. So the whole idea is to train the helicopter crews in judgmental training as to make these sort of split second decisions and keep within the rules of engagement in the very, very sort of complex battlefield that Afghanistan represents.
And you got the opportunity to fly on some aircraft there as well, didn't you?
I did. I got we had a little fly around the exercise zone in a Sea King Commando, which was quite good fun.
Yeah.
In formation with another Sea King.
Interesting stuff. So where do you see the future of helicopters in the UK military services moving forwards?
Well, like everything else, it's pretty bleak at the moment. The extra Chinooks are welcome, but if we're going to be honest about this, they really should have entered service in 2006, when it was obvious that we were in for the long haul in Afghanistan. Future Wildcat, it should be useful for the Navy. However, it's being bought in sort of penny packets, and there's also some questions over whether what is its role for the Army. It's too big, really, to be an observation or sort of a scout helicopter, and it's too small to be a really sort of useful transport helicopter. So there's all sort of question marks hanging over it.
And does the Lynx still remain? I think it was the fastest helicopter at one time. Does it still hold that record?
I believe it does, yes. Obviously, the Sikorsky X-2 has beaten that, but that is a coaxial helicopter.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of the single rotor helicopter, the Lynx is still the fastest helicopter.
Oh, well, we still have one positive thing left in our armory then. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us again. Where can our listeners find you online?
Well, the best place to look for us is on www.aerosocietychannel.com, or if you're on Twitter, I'm at RAES Tim R.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks to be on.
You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Moving on to listener mail, we have a few voicemails for you. The first one comes from Ryan. He has a question on interviewing pilots after an incident.
Hey, guys. I want to thank you for really great shows. And just to raise a question for you that has been perplexing me, I have never seen the answer in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or on Airplane Geeks podcast. And that is, when there's an incident, like the one with Southwest Airlines and the decompression and the need to lower the plane very quickly from 36,000 feet to 10,000 feet, why does no one get to interview the pilots? Why do we never hear the pilot's account of what happened in this incident or incidents like it? It seems like, with the exception of Captain Sullenberger, we almost never hear the pilot side of the incident or the story. So anyway, just a question for all you experts on airline operations and the business of covering them. Thanks very much. This is Brian Carlson from Reston, Virginia. Thank you.
My guess, part of it is the airline may not want the pilots to be talking publicly to. I mean, Chris, if there was ever an incident on one of your flights, I would assume your airline wouldn't be happy if you started talking to reporters, right?
Well, I wouldn't even worry about what the airline says. It's liability. I mean, you're going to be second guessed constantly, and you want to stay under the protection of when you have an FAA hearing. and an NTSB hearing that it's privileged information. And as soon as you start talking, again, whatever lawsuits were going to come out of whatever happened in that incident, and you're out speaking publicly, you won't find an airline pilot with an ounce of common sense that wants to talk to the press about that. And, you know, you're certainly grilled by the FAA, the NTSB. And that's certainly sufficient. And you speak within the protected environment, the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder as well. But as soon as you start talking publicly, I have no idea why anybody would – I would not want to talk publicly. I would have nothing to say, you know.
That makes sense.
And just to go to Ryan's point about Captain Sullenberger from U.S. Airways 1549, I think the reason that was an exception is, A, it was just such a huge event for to perform a water landing in the Hudson River. But also, if I recall correctly, I believe Captain Sullenberger actually had his own personal website. So it was once someone was able to get his name, he was very easy to find and get his picture online. And I think it was a lot easier to do research on him as opposed to other pilots.
Well, plus I'm sure once it's said and done, it's all settled that everybody was cleared and they did a fine job. Well, that's a whole different thing, but that's not news anymore. In his case, it is, of course, since it was such an exceptional event. But the average thing, like a decompression at 37,000 feet, mums the word, not saying a word, want to not get sued by everyone, which is the way things go these days. And by the time it is all cleared up, nobody's interested anymore anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
I mean, that is true. Yeah. But I think for U.S. Airways, I'm pretty sure they had like his name out there the night of. But
yeah, just the thing is, like, our standard procedure is you're going to be sequestered in a hotel with union attorneys and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Okay. We got a couple of voicemails on the issue of child seats in airplanes. First, Stephen has a comment about child seats and also about shift start time. And then we'll listen to Benet Wilson.
Hey, guys. It's Stephen out in California. Two updates, just listening to the current episode. Just wanted to comment on the car seat issue for infants on the airplane. Being an airline employee, which leads into my second comment, we actually have used out of the stroller, I guess, the seat for infants that comes with, like, strollers that you can use in the car. We've actually used that with our daughter after she was first born, flying from California back to Boston. And I guess being an airline employee, you have advantage of whatever seats are left or disadvantage. You get what you take, but usually we've ended up in the first row. So we've always had three together. So, and of course that's on an A320. So, I don't have any issue with it. Granted, there's no seat pitch because it's row one. I mean, you don't have a seat in front. You don't have anybody trying to recline the seat back. But it did work for our daughter. The second comment I wanted to make was to the Rob's question about who works at 4:30 in the morning. Well, if you're starting the operation in the ops office, you would start at 4:30 in the morning if you have fleet launch at 7. That's my answer. Otherwise, I'm at work at 5:30 in the morning for a ramp or bag room shifts. So that's it. Keep up the good work. Enjoyed the episode so far with the guest from Harrisburg Airport, which I'll have to check out on Twitter. Anyway, keep up the good work. Take care. Bye.
Well, thanks, Stephen, for that. And we also have Benet's comments on child seats and airplanes.
Hi, airplane geeks. It's Benet, your aviation queen. I have to tell you, number one, Stephanie was wonderful on the show. I mean, she really gave it to Rob, and he needs that sometimes. But I'm actually calling about one of my favorite topics, children and seating on aircraft. First, there are no rear-facing seats that fit into airplanes. Like I said, Clarissa, we made a conscious decision with Clarissa to always buy her own seat. And my parents were kind enough to buy me the stroller and the car seat that was FAA approved. And then as she got a little older, my parents bought that SkyMall stroller / car seat, also FAA approved, and that was a godsend. And the CARES harness system is for older children. When Clarissa turned 4, she was kind of outgrowing that SkyMall stroller, so we started using the CARES system. but it seems like the airlines would have to do some major things with seat pitch in order to do the rear facing. And I have said this before, and I don't judge, but everybody has their own preference. But my feeling is you want your child to be safe. And I would never ride in a car with Clarissa in my lap as a baby or as a toddler. So why do it on an airplane? But that's just I'm not judging anyone, but that's my personal opinion. And then last but not least, I loved the chitter chatter about the military stuff, even though you guys know that tends to bore me. And I lived at Mildenhall, when I was younger. My dad was in the Air Force, as you well know, and we actually lived at Mildenhall. And when I heard you guys pronouncing it different, I was like, is that Mildenhall? Because we used to go to Lake Heath. And anyway, so that is all I have, but I hope that this baby information has been helpful. And again, great show with Stephanie. You've got to have her on again. Bye-bye, geeks.
Did I just hear Binet admit to liking a military history segment? Maybe there is hope for her.
It's got to be the stellar job you're doing, David, bringing life to the military arena of aviation to those that are more commercial oriented.
So I just have an idea, and I'm not saying we should do this, but I'm pretty sure if we had Binet and Stephanie at the same time, Rob would have no self-esteem left.
Yeah, that's the killer combination. So the discussion about child and infant safety in airlines is kind of continues. I think we've learned a few things about what's available. It sort of still remains to be seen to what degree the airlines are going to contribute to the conversation about safety of children on airplanes.
I know a lot of folks bring their car seats and they don't really intend them for the airplane. They intend them for the car trip afterwards, which is fine. But they're going to find, and they do find, we have a lot of spitting contest at the gate at the aircraft door because they don't want it downstairs. But there's no room to stow it upstairs and they weren't going to use it in the first place. But, if I could tell them, and I do tell them when I see them, at Target, at Babies R Us, Walmart, they sell really cheap plastic covers that you can put these things in and they'll go in the cargo hold. And I would not want my child seat in the cargo hold if it wasn't protected. Nah. I mean, you could put it in a hefty bag, but there are some that are like $20 that'll designed to fit a car seat and put it in the cargo hold, particularly if you're not going to use it in the aircraft, because there is no room to stow that thing.
Okay. That's good advice. Let's see. We can zip through a few emails that we received. First comes from Robert, says, thanks for the podcast. To the public, some of the most painful part of commercial flying comes from ATC delays and TSA inconsistencies. It seems airlines should have a strong lobbying presence in D.C. to keep a dialogue with FAA, ATC, and TSA. Do they? And would that make an interesting topic to hear more about?
Oh, they absolutely do. They absolutely do. The industry group that does all that lobbying, however, the TSA is not to be lobbied. They're just not going to do anything. They're going to do what they do. And there are inconsistencies because I'll go to an airport, I'll be in Salt Lake City, and there's one procedure, and then I'll be in Boston, there's another, and you can't tell them. You say, this isn't the way it's always done. Oh, yes, it's done everywhere. Well, I go to 10 different airports a week, and you don't. No, it's a standard procedure. So, I feel that frustration that the TSA is inconsistent depending on where you are. And they're not about to be lobbied or anything changed.
Yeah, interesting.
And I guess I've noticed it actually. Same thing as I believe, for example, I have an iPad, and I believe the rule is, since it's the iPad does not need to come out of your bag to be scanned. Correct. Like a laptop, but
Correct.
It's like half the time I'm told to do it anyway. But just to go back to Robert's question, there definitely are many groups that are involved in dealing with the government. Lobbying isn't their only task, but the big one domestically would be the Air Transport Association. Their website is airlines.org. There's also the Regional Airline Association. While they're not an airline group, another trade association that does certainly have a lot of input on security is the AAAE, American Association of Airport Executives. And also, a lot of the big labor unions also are dealing with government affairs a long time, like ALPA, APA, the APFA. Mm-hmm. Certainly you would think like a pilots union, for example, would have a a very significant interest in communicating with the FAA over things like duty time. So, yeah, there are a bunch of groups.
The other thing that he has to understand with ATC delays, too, is with the Passenger Bill of Rights. Nowadays, if there is any significant delay, the airline basically has to sell the airplane and give all the money to the passengers. Because the fines are so humongous, you'll see cancellation on warning. And some of the stats that have come out is, yeah, we have less delays, but we have so many cancellations. And once, you know, your Bill of Rights expires as soon as you don't have a seat. So now you're standby with no rights. Mm. You instead of being 4 hours late, you may be 2 days late, and that's just, well, it saved you from having to sit on that airplane with all the anecdotal problems that, you know, spawned that legislation in the first place.
Chris, who makes the call in a situation like that where there's a long wait and the choice is, are we going to cancel this flight or not? Who makes that call?
Well, the operations people do, but we're constantly kept aware of how much the clock is ticking towards that limit, and we don't even come close. Yeah, we won't come close to it. And nowadays, and that's the delays now are more gate delays because it's like we're not even going to board. We're not even going to push back until we know that we have a half chance, which at Kennedy, LaGuardia, Chicago, several of those places, there'll be lots of delays in the terminal. You didn't get it on the tarmac, but, you know, that's – yeah. Okay. I keep the clock running myself, and I know that if we're getting close to it, we'll just go back to the gate.
Great. All right. We also heard from Dr. Steve again. He says, sounds like the FAA is taking its cues from the motivational specialists I endured years ago in the Strategic Air Command. Quote, punishment will continue until performance and morale improves. Dr. Steve says the number of controllers falling asleep has to be indicative of a bigger problem like rotating shifts, inadequate rest time, etc., interfering with sleep. It's hard to believe there are that many who want to commit career suicide. How about an interview with a human factors or sleep expert? So that's what Rob did in his Jetwine blog. I don't know if Rob saw Dr. Steve's email and rushed out and responded in his blog before we could do that in the podcast. But since that's what Rob has done, I invite you to take a look at jetwine.com for Rob's thoughts on this. And he's got some input from a human factors expert. Okay, we heard from Sikar again. He says, thanks for reading my email on the episode. It would be great if you could get together an expert on the F-35 and have a good discussion on the propulsion and history of the plane. I have a fair bit of knowledge about the Harrier, as a friend of mine flies Sea Harriers, and since I am a diehard enthusiast, I have seen the base operations up close many times. He says, I had raised the topic with him a couple of times, and the feeling was that although the lift fan solves a major problem in Harrier operations in hot climates, weight penalty to maneuvering in combat operations would be significant. However, since the real numbers are secret and confidential, nobody other than... So, David, who is this? LM/US DOD, Department of Defense.
Lockheed Martin.
Lockheed Martin, US... Okay, there it is. Now I get it. Nobody other than Lockheed Martin and the US DOD would actually know. Obviously, the Harrier pilots love the cockpit automation features of the F-35, as the Sea Harrier has an analog cockpit, and the flying workload is extremely high. David and I are going to try to come up with a little segment on the F-35 and the Harrier, at least looking at it from the standpoint of the lift systems. David, do you think we can pull off something interesting?
I think so. Like I admitted to Max, I know how a Harrier Pegasus 2 engine works. That makes perfect sense to me. It's going to take a bit for us to figure out how the fan works. I'm still not quite sure how that operates. So I'm admitting ignorance, but I'm also giving commitment to that I will find out, and we will let you guys know.
Sounds great. Sikar went on. He has a PS that's kind of interesting. We had talked about, or one of our listeners had talked about the idea of tipping cabin crew and flight crew. I'm waiting for Chris to weigh in on this. And we had a little bit of action going on at the Airplane Geeks Facebook page on this. So Sikar has an opinion about the tipping. He says, a friend of mine was a waiter and then a bartender in a restaurant in Texas during college. And he had told me that the reason why tips were extremely important to the wait staff is that their basic pay, $2 an hour, is way below minimum wage, which was $5.25 an hour in 2001, and they are expected to make it up in tips. However, airline in flight staff and maintenance/support staff are on salary with benefits way above minimum wages, and they certainly don't require tips. Just my 2 cents.
No, yeah. I mean, nobody, that's, you know, no, nobody expects a tip.
Has anybody ever tipped you, Chris?
Don't run with scissors or something. No, in fact, especially with the 7.3, the cockpit being is like a quarter to the cockpit, we don't even see the people.
Yeah.
And the door lock to reach the lock is so far out of my seat, I'm like, it's too hard. We'll just sit.
Just stay
so
there.
The door's closed most of the time.
Right, right. Okay. One more from Andy. Andy is the listener who attended the SR-71 talk at the Imperial War Museum in Duxford by Colonel Richard Graham, retired from the U.S. Air Force. And he sent along a lot of interesting information from the talk. And some of the things that I thought were particularly interesting was that he says each crew is paired up in training. They always flew together, never with anyone else. So if one guy was sick, say a cold, his crewmate could not fly either. The bond between crew was imperative. They really had to know the way each worked and thought and to get on very well. They spent weeks together on attachment at Okinawa and Mildenhall. Notice I didn't say Mildenhall this time. Well, Chris, that's interesting. Is there an analogy in the commercial world?
No.
You guys, it's just a random kind of selection?
Well, we have such standardization, you could fly with anyone. And sometimes in the course of a 3-day trip, if they're out of first officers, you get one for these two legs. And then the next day you pick up a new one. And that's the beauty of at least what we have at American Airlines. Such complete standardization is as soon as that guy sits down, we're all on the same page. Hmm. Okay. I know, you know, completely. We're all doing the exact same standard procedures, and that's a real comfort to us. Of course, it is to the airline, but mostly to us that you could anyone who gets in that seat, we're good.
All right. Also, some more interesting things. Some facts on the SR-71 tire pressures: 4,000 psi. He says at this pressure, FOD damage, foreign object damage, FOD, FOD damage could be catastrophic. So the backup flight crew drove a car and meticulously searched the runway and taxiways just prior to takeoff. He says an SR-71 was lost to a tire failure. It caught fire and ran off the runway, but the crew got out okay. Other interesting facts on the SR-71, the airframe increased by 6 inches in length at altitude due to heating from friction of the air. Expanding of the metal.
I can vouch for that firsthand because when I was at Kadena and flew in Okinawa at Kadena for 2 years, and you'd be running on the taxiway when the SR-71 taxied by, it was dripping JP-7 all over the place, and you could actually put a fire out with JP-7, which is the reason it was designed that way. It required really extremely high ignition so that it was much safer because that airplane just leaked everywhere until it sealed when it got hot and expanded.
Were you going to say something, David?
No, okay. Chris stole my thunder. So,
what, you were running on the taxiway, Kadena, as well?
No, but I was going to talk about expanding fuselages, leaking fuel, and putting out fires with JP7.
Yeah. When we would fly with JP7, you had to use constant high joule ignition because it's not going to. You'll end up flaming out your engines when we're normally using JP4, JP7. If you took a gallon, you could throw it on a fire and put it out.
And that's why there were KC-135Qs, which had special tanks that had the JP-7 in it compared to the normal JP-4 that they were using to fly in.
Yeah, and you could burn the JP-7, but you had to have high joule ignition the whole time, whereas normally you don't have to do that.
Dan, now you know what it feels like when you're going over spreadsheets. Are you completely lost yet?
Because you were such an effective teacher, no. See how I turned that around?
And you guys are showing your knowledge because you've actually covered a couple of items that Andy wrote about. He did have a favorite fact. He said the engines at full burner at operating height at Mach 3 plus only produce 20% of the thrust. 80% of the thrust is produced by the variable inlet shock cones and the bypass air, which is taken in to the engine nacelle, slowed, bypasses the turbine, and gets reaccelerated and ejected from the nacelle or further back. And that's because the engine, the J-58s, they're actually both a turbojet and a ramjet, or a fan-assisted ramjet. And so Andy's report is correct in that at altitude, the ramjet function takes over and produces the bulk of the thrust. So I want to thank Andy for providing all that interesting information on the SR-71 from the talk he attended. All right, that's the show. Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Igor Sikorsky III. Find his website at www.bradfordcamps.com. And again, I'll say if you're looking for a fantastic getaway kind of vacation, take a look at the Bradford Camps. It's a beautiful place. You get your own cabin. You got your own lake. You have great food. You can go hunting, fishing, canoeing. And if you go during Sikorsky weekend, you can immerse yourself in more history than you can possibly imagine. Highly recommend.
I so want to do that.
David, you should just do it. It's great. And we'd also like to thank our guest co-host, Chris Mano. Chris, you've got a couple of websites and Twitter. Why don't you tell folks where they can find more about you?
Well, Jethead, it's just as it sounds, jethead.wordpress.com is the blog. It's an insider look at being an airline captain. Then if you just want the goofy cartoons, it's flightcrewzoo.com. Of course, I'm on Twitter. It's mostly pictures, twit pics. I get some good panoramics, some really pretty cool pictures from 30, 40,000 feet. So that's just on Twitter. It's always a pleasure to be here with you guys. You guys have a great show. I always enjoy listening to it and taking part.
Oh, thanks for that, Steve. Very kind. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
And Dan Webb, how about you?
You can find me where the wild things are. or my blog, thingsinthesky.com, on Twitter, Dan Webbage. And I have a quick correction from last week because I was an idiot. When we were talking about the FAA and oxygen masks and inventories, I said it was Homeland that issued this. It was the FAA, and I was an idiot, and I'm sorry. So there's that.
Apology accepted. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory, also on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links to all the sites that we mentioned on the podcast, as well as listener comments and even Airplane Geeks t-shirts. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. You can send us email. That address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And as always, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. And Bene Wilson will give us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is provided by the amazing Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. Finally, if you'd really like to help us out, go tell your friends about us. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you later.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
I honestly think they're one of the most transparent airlines. I'm sorry. We're going to start that again.
Wow.
What did you do?
I got up and I stepped on my headset cord and my headset then proceeded to fly off my head.
Don't break your brand new headset.
The way it's been going, I'd actually be happy if this happened. But David, by the way.
Yes.
I've been spending the past few minutes going through some A380 stuff. Apparently, the A380 waiver is for 75-foot taxiways.
Okay. Care. What do I know? It's a civilian airport. I only know concrete hard stands for military bases. Because Japan was stuck in retribution for the attacks and it only occurred 4 months ago on... Stop. Let's start this again.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's Schiphol, guys. Schiphol. Schiphol. Use that for a blooper. Schiphol. 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 You know, you got to use a lot of phlegm and lots of O's if you're going to speak Dutch. We should ring up Baz.
Yeah, is he online?
He speaks South Australian and Dutch.
Sounds like a bit of a Schiphol to me, mate.
Schiphol winning.
What's up, Schiphol?
What's up, Schiphol?
What's up, Skip? He's gone Dutch. Oh, what's up, Skip-all? And now, folks, a doctor with a flashlight will show us where Steve got that figure from.
Second worst recording of all time.
Well, today we welcome back Tim. Tim is the editor of Aerospace International, and today Tim joins us to talk about the UK Rotary Fleet.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Sorry, Tim. I'll say that again. I spit that through my teeth.
Did you guys see Rob on Geraldo the other night?
No.
I did. I stayed up.
You stayed up till 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I missed him.
It was good. I feel they should have given Rob some more airtime, but and I was really hoping Geraldo would be wearing a Jetwine button during the interview.
Now, that would have been something.
You know, and at least he could do, I mean, he's only on for 30 seconds, but at least 15 seconds of that he could do is throw some love to his fellow airplane geeks. But, you know, and he wonders why he gets abused.